Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is Suzanne Spaulding, Senior Advisor for Homeland Security and the Director of the Defending Democratic Institutions Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She served on the Cyberspace Solarium Commission and is a former Undersecretary at the Department of Homeland Security who led the National Protection and Programs Directorate that has become the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Vago. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you back on. It's also great to have you on shortly after we talked to CISA Director Chris Krebs, who succeeded you in the role over at Department of Homeland Security. You had a great event recently with Nina Jankowicz of the Wilson Center at the launch of her new book, How to Lose an Information War. Misinformation and disinformation operations have been a very hot topic since before the 2016 election, and it's gotten hotter as concerns about Russian and Chinese meddling in this year's election cycle have been renewed. The bigger issue, I think, is how foreign powers are using the openness of democracies to exacerbate toxic divisions in our societies. Britain just recently also put out a report that said Russian interference has gone unchecked in the UK. As these campaigns are being fought largely in cyberspace, what's the approach that free societies have to protect themselves at the government, at the corporate, as well as on the individual citizen level?
Yeah, great question. I think those are action does need to be taken at all those levels. So, you know, I think one of the key roles for the federal government is to try to deter this kind of activity, right? To send very clear signals to our adversaries that this is not acceptable behavior, particularly interference in our political discourse around our elections. But we know that these information operations go much beyond elections. In fact, I've been looking for the last 3 years at evidence of Russia's information operations targeting our justice system as part of a broad campaign to undermine public trust and confidence in democracy and its institutions generally. So we need to make it very clear that this is not acceptable behavior at the federal government level. We also need to be taking actions to try to protect ourselves from having our political discourse warped through disinformation and information operations, and recognize that it can have very serious implications, as we've seen around the disinformation around COVID, that can actually, you know, influence life and death decisions that individuals make. So we need to do what we can to protect against that, in addition to trying to deter actors. And the protection piece really is, to a large extent, in the hands of the social media platforms that need to be using their tools and capabilities to police for this, detect this, and deal with it appropriately. And then individuals. And there, I think we're really looking at resilience. We have been focused on trying to build public resilience against this pernicious messaging that our adversaries are carrying out. And that means everything from, yes, media literacy, that's important, understanding how to be better consumers of information. But it also means something as fundamental as renewal of civic education, to remind us all of our shared values when our adversaries try to amplify and exacerbate our divisions, to remind us of the importance of democracy, that it is under attack, we can't take it for granted, and that each and every one of us has a role to play to defend it. And that includes being equipped to be more effective agents of change, to hold our institutions accountable and make them better. Our institutions are not perfect. But what Russia and others are trying to get us to do is to give up on them and despair. And we need to build public resilience against that kind of despair.
We just heard from the Brits, though, who admitted that they've been doing a bad job on it. And the fact that we're still talking about this issue suggests that we're not doing as good of a job on it as well, whether it's from the civic education side of things, but also on the rather irregular approach that social media companies have had toward the spreading of disinformation, right? I mean, this stuff has been successful because you can create thousands of fake accounts and then try to use that as a megaphone. What on a, and I know that the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, of which you were one of the commissioners, addressed this issue. What are some of the legislative changes we need to make in order to legislate against bad behavior?
Yeah, I think that's actually very difficult to do. And I think we need to be mindful that one of the things that certainly I think Russia is trying to do is to exercise jujitsu against us, if you will, you know, using our strength against us, our strength that comes from freedom of speech and from a robust marketplace of ideas. And we need to remember that is a strength, and we need to combat this using our strengths. So I think reaching for restrictions on speech is really a last resort. I'm not saying that it is never appropriate. I think there are certainly times, and I think platforms need to continue to work to identify inauthentic activity where individuals are pretending to be Americans when they're really operating out of Russia, for example, or bots that artificially make something appear to be more popular and mainstream than it is. I think those sorts of things should be taken down. But I think with regard to content of speech, providing individuals with tools to better discern what they're looking at is something that we need to reach for first before we give in to the instinct to restrict speech.
As everybody looks to do a better job, what are the countries that are getting it right that can serve as models? And how do we adapt their experience into the U.S. model, which is unique in some respects, right? I mean, we're not smaller countries like Estonia or Sweden, for example.
Yes, and that is an advantage. Sweden has a fairly homogeneous population, for example, and it's small, and they've done a very good job. They've been under significant attack through information operations, and yet they have done a very good job of educating their public to the nature, scale, and scope of the threat, and helping them to resist it, building that public resilience. Estonia, again, you cite another small country with early experience dealing with Russian information operations and cyber attacks, working together, that has done a pretty good job, again, of pushing back. The Czech Republic got off to a very good start, setting up a dedicated center to focus on foreign influence operations, particularly those from Russia. Unfortunately, there seems to be a growing divide between the dedication of the folks at that center and where the central government wants to go and the degree to which they are continue to be interested in pushing back on information operations. And I think we can learn some lessons there about how to handle a disconnect between the top leadership and their interest in pushing back on inference operations and the working level folks. But I think it is important to look at how other countries are handling this. France, for example, had the benefit of our experience in 2016 in our election before they had their national election. And they learned from that, and they did some things better. And so we've had to learn from them.
And of course, right, the French also asked reporters to not propagate bad information. And there was a little moratorium, as I recall, that journalists sort of restrained the urge to go and just run with fake news at the time. Let me follow up on one point that you made about the disconnect within governments. Hungary, for example, has actually a pretty robust disinformation apparatus that it's created. The United States has been working on it. But what happens when the leaders of these countries, whether it's Viktor Orban or Donald Trump, are folks who are actually not just peddling in disinformation, but also have repeatedly shown to be susceptible to it?
Yeah, that's a major problem. It's really very difficult to pull together the kind of whole of nation response that you need to address this very significant threat if you don't have someone at the top who believes that it's important, who understands the nature of the threat to our democracy, and is willing to support those throughout government and in the private sector who are in academia and think tanks, all of whom are trying to understand the nature, scale, and scope of this threat and find ways to counter it. It's really problematic not having someone who thinks this is a serious threat. And it's even worse, as you point out, when we see the most senior leadership spreading disinformation. And it's very difficult to effectively counter this threat in that kind of an environment. It's one of the reasons I think that the platforms are under so much pressure, because we look to them then to step in and deal with activity that is not being deterred by the federal government, as I noted at the outset.
And I also find it interesting that whenever a Twitter or a Facebook moves to contain disinformation, they then become the target of people who want to peddle in the disinformation. So it's a little bit like a snake eating its tail kind of thing. Let me ask you one last question. And, you know, you were on the Solarium Commission. Those 75 or so recommendations that you guys put out were very thoughtful. They were done in a very coordinated fashion, both with the administration and lawmakers, so that we could rapidly implement them. And yet it seems as though we have sort of run out of steam. The administration opposes the idea of a national cyber director. The House has positive language in it, but it's still held up in the Senate. We'll see how that goes. Is there a concern in your mind that such a great effort that is so overdue with so many common sense recommendations could actually stall and fizzle out before we actually push through and make the changes we need to make to make the nation safer?
No, actually, I'm very optimistic that a surprising number of our recommendations in the Cyberspace Solarium report will in fact be part of the National Defense Authorization Act when it is ultimately enacted. We had over 80 recommendations, and if I recall correctly, somewhere between 40 and 50 of those involved congressional action. And a pretty sizable segment of that, probably less than half, but still a good number of those, thanks to the great work of our congressional members of the Solarium Commissions, Senator Angus King, Mike Gallagher, and particularly Congressman Jim Langevin, who chairs the Cybersecurity and Emerging Technologies Subcommittee. They have worked very hard at getting bipartisan support for so many of our recommendations. And many of them are in either the House or the Senate versions or both. And so we're optimistic. A key recommendation of the commission was to create a national cyber director. And that is a recommendation that is not yet at least supported by the White House. But it does have bipartisan support, certainly in the House, and so we'll continue to push for that. I think it's an important recommendation. I don't know that Congress will ultimately, at the end of the day, include it.
Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure having you back on, and look forward to having you on again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook @Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And we'll see you again tomorrow.